Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We'll have your later letters coming up later. This hour, why so many women don't tell. As I've watched the Me Too hashtag unleash a torrent of sickening stories and allegations of sexual harassment and assault on Twitter, I've considered how familiar this is, and I realized it's because this is what my friends and I have been talking about quietly for years. We all knew which politicians, which colleagues, which bosses, which sources to be leery of, and we shared that among ourselves. Can you think of anyone among your women friends who does not have some story about harassment? It's what one journalist calls the whisper network, and those whispers have become roars, and this has to be more than a moment from which we quickly move on. And that's what we're going to talk about today. In order for that to happen, women have to feel empowered to tell, to speak out. Today, a conversation about making change out of the moment. And I'd like to hear from you on this. If you're a woman, did you face that agonizing choice of speaking out about the harassment or the insult that you endured? How do you feel today about the decision that you made? And for the men listening, are you hearing what women are saying about this loud and clear? What can men do about it? So as women, I want to talk about this choice that I made, that a lot of us made, to not speak up about it, to not talk out loud about it, and how we feel today about that choice and whether we feel like we are more empowered to speak out and to tell. And for the men listening, I want to know if you hear what women are saying about this and what you think men can do to contribute to make a change around this. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. Susan Chira is with us. She is a senior correspondent and editor on gender issues for the New York Times, and she's with us from New York. Susan, good to have you back on the show. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Carrie.
Shireen Alamzadeh is an attorney and founder of Healing to Action, which works to end gender violence. And she's with us today from Chicago. And Shireen, welcome. It's good to have you on the show, too.
Thank you for having me.
Susan, I know there are power in numbers. It's why so many women now feel empowered that they can say something about this. But I have to say, the breadth of this, entertainment, politics, sports, tech, is just really discouraging. And I wonder what you've been thinking as you've seen this unfold.
Yes, well, I think it's a fascinating moment. And I think that, you know, it may be that some people thought that the more overt kinds of brazen sexual harassment had kind of faded as more women entered the workforce. And what I think has been now proven decisively is this is as endemic as it was in the Mad Men era, except that it was perhaps people understood, the harassers may have understood that it had to be done slightly more covertly.
Right.
But I think that what we've seen is that even though so many more women are working in so many different fields from elite to non-elite, you still have the toxic combination of the fact that sexual harassment is really about power as much as it is about sex, if not more, and that men still have enormous amounts of power and feel that they can use that power to coerce sexual favors or to come on to women, and that women have been legitimately afraid of speaking out because we know that women who do speak out often suffer really severe consequences.
I want to get into that. Shireen, I also want to ask you, and I feel like Susan has nailed the can you believe this part of this moment, which is it never ended. I guess women, I've just said, we sit around and we talk about this. I guess I knew that. I just didn't realize that there's so much of it. It's so brazen, and so many women have stories about this across the board in so many different industries. Tell me what's occurred to you as you've watched this.
Well, I've been really heartened to see people speaking out about it. You know, I work with survivors of workplace sexual violence every day, and I do think that it's true that a lot of the time it makes a lot more sense doing a rational calculation to stay silent. But, you know, it's moments like these where we have an opportunity to really talk about it, put it out there, and try to figure out solutions to the issue. So I'm heartened by the moment. I'm hopeful that we can do something. And, you know, I think that what is clear is that this is really an issue that's been really normalized. And that's why it hasn't been coming out into the open, because I think a lot of women just see this as part of their job. They just see, you know, having to deal with these issues on their own as something that they have to do as a part of their ability to earn a living.
And Shireen, listen to this from Ruth on Twitter. She says, it's a near universal female experience. It would take days to relate them. 14 years of bartending, wearying male patrons at the high-end hotel where I worked, regularly made wildly profane, inappropriate passes. Reporting equals endangering your job. Shireen, it's just what you've just said, that women just kind of said, this is what it's like to work at fill in the blank, and this is what I have to tolerate. Which some of this, you know, as I think about the way I talked about this with my friends, I realize there was responsibility on me too and us too to speak out about it. Let's talk about why we don't. And that comes back to what Susan was saying. Shireen, why don't so many women tell?
Well, you have to think about it from that moment in time when this happens to a person, what's going through their head. So they're sitting there and they're thinking, what are the benefits to me for coming forward? What are the benefits to my workplace? And they have their job on the line. They have their reputation on the line. They have gone through trauma. They don't necessarily want to relive that trauma, especially if they don't know if it's going to be met with support. They're worried that nothing is going to happen and that that will make things even worse for them. And so there are a lot of really rational reasons that women decide not to report. And I think the more important question is, why is that the calculation that they have to make? What are we doing as a society where a woman, you know, by and large, statistically, the most common response for women who go through this is to completely try to manage the situation by themselves.
Exactly.
To, you know, try to avoid the person, try to, you know, minimize what's happening, make jokes about it. The least common response is making a formal complaint. And we have to ask ourselves why. You know, this is a systemic problem. It's not a bunch of, you know, it's not half of our population making a bad decision. I think the bigger and broader question we need to be asking is, why is that the case that people feel when this has been done to them that they are on their own?
If you're getting a busy signal as you're trying to call in, call us back. I'm asking you for, as a woman, whether you face that choice. I can't think of a friend among my group of friends who hasn't had some experience with this. So as you, and I did too, early on in my radio career, if you faced this choice of, do I speak out? Should I make that choice of managing it, as Shireen has just said, as most of us do? And how do you feel about that decision today? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Lynn in Bloomington. Hi, Lynn. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I'm so glad you could get me on. Part of the problem isn't that we make this decision when we're adults in the situation. My stepsister, when she was 4, kept getting tackled by a little neighbor boy who'd come over, and he would try and kiss her. And all the grown-ups thought it was cute, even when she asked for them to please step in. When I was 12, a boy bullied me about my looks at school every day, and I finally told a teacher, and he said, just ignore him. So early we learn that what we want doesn't matter. This happens in childhood.
Susan, you think this is a point we're conditioned, socialized around this early on to deal with it?
I think that that's a really important point, that a lot of women are told, oh, well, maybe you should be flattered, or, oh, you know, that's just so-and-so. You can ignore it, as the caller said. And I think that women in general are kind of encouraged to be compliant and to kind of get along and cope. And I think as one gets older, there's other variants on this caller's experience. It's like, oh, he's just joking. Oh, that's just so-and-so. You know, he doesn't have a filter. Or, you know, in other words, I think that there are repeated experiences both in childhood when it's minimized and in adulthood when it all gets caught up with, you know, the attitudes of those hearing it. Now, I do think there are corporations that take it seriously and workplaces that take it seriously, but I also think that women hesitate because they're trying to figure out, at least at the beginning, is this something that can be managed? And, you know,
exactly.
do I want to, you know, make an enemy of this person? Do I want to go through this formal process? Can I kind of send a clear signal to butt out and end it there? And, you know, I actually know young women who have come to me for counsel. I want to say this did not involve the New York Times, but I had a young friend who was at a very reputable, public-spirited organization whose boss was inappropriately coming on to her. And, you know, I said, we sort of talked it through. She was reluctant to go because he had direct power over her career. I said, well, you can try this, talk to him once, and then if it happens one more time, you've got to go to a formal command. But I think, you know, maybe in hindsight, I should have said go immediately. But, you know, I can understand that you try to say, maybe if I send a firm signal, it'll end.
For sure.
And that is not necessarily the case.
And it usually doesn't. And what I regret about not speaking out when it was happening in several different situations is I knew that, and I think I knew that then, Susan, that if I didn't say anything, he had full license to do this with plenty of other women. And I knew
right.
that. I knew
right.
I wasn't the only one he was doing with that. That's kind of the responsibility and the obligation,
but
I think about now. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add one thing, which is that I think that really we have so many concrete examples. I don't want it to be self-blame, because I think that there are a lot of concrete examples of clear retaliation, of clear harmful effects on career. Just to cite reporting the Times has done, if you looked at women who did not cooperate with Bill O'Reilly and never appeared on his show again, mm-hmm. or somehow, you know, their professional careers were obliterated, I think we have to recognize that this is not just, oh, I wasn't brave enough to speak out. This is, there were, in fact, observable, concrete repercussions. And I've seen this in reporting the Times has done, and I've done in multiple workplaces where women feel that nothing will be done and the only person who will be hurt is them. And so as you pointed out, there's a structural issue to make clear that they will be protected. And I don't think that women feel that. And
That's
I don't
right.
think there are enough systems in place broadly enough to feel that.
And here's part of the reason, just a little context here before we go back to the phones. The EEOC study that we've now been seeing in publications on retaliation is saying more than 75% of the women who reported sexual harassment endured retaliation. We know this happens. This figures into the decisions that we make around this. Here's somebody who called in anonymously in St. Paul. This happened to me, and I'm afraid of retaliation. You often get people at the senior levels, HR departments, that are complicit. Bad person gets promoted and turns a blind eye. Fortune 300 firm. It's an office vicious circle, awful vicious circle. To Karen in St. Paul. Hi, Karen. It sounds like this has happened to you. Okay, to Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. I'm glad you're listening to the show. What are you taking from it?
Wow, I've got to tell you, this is some really, I think, heavy stuff, to say the least. Sunday was a really hard day, like seeing all the stuff online, you know. And as somebody who, I have a lot of women friends, and I was to see the number of them who had, like, said me too, you know, but I didn't know. You know, I didn't know it was them too. It was really, I don't know, it was hard to explain. The thing I wanted to kind of throw into the conversation was
sure.
this. I mean, the behavior is, it's inexcusable. I mean, there's no way to defend this, you know. But I think men have to drill down deeper than the behavior. It's really on men. The onus is on men in some regard to deal with this. We have to hold ourselves accountable. There's some element, there's some thread. What keeps coming up for me is that men can't deal with this because we can't even talk about our emotions, a lot of us. You know, I'm a pretty fairly progressive guy, mm-hmm. and I, in some ways, have a pretty limited emotional palate. It's growing. And I don't know, there's something about how we handle our emotions or don't handle our emotions and how that's handed down from father to son or from family to family, you know, generation to generation, that I think is a linchpin in this. And I think that's part of what has to be addressed. So I guess that's where I'm at.
Good. Yeah, I mean, let me go back to Shireen and Susan with that. Shireen, what do you think?
I think that's absolutely true. And going back to sort of what Susan was talking about in terms of how children are conditioned to behave, both boys and girls, and the idea that engaging in aggressive behavior is, you know, sort of a male trait, that boys will be boys, and this is just something we have to deal with. And what a disservice this does, not just to our girls who become conditioned to believe this is something they have to accept, but also to our boys who don't have a full emotional register, as the caller mentioned, who aren't able to really engage with, you know, feelings of compassion and consideration and respect the way that I think we really should be promoting among our children. And so I think that, you know, understanding the limitations that these gender roles are placing on all of us is really important, and really helping men to see the stake that they have in addressing this problem, not just as an ally, but because we all benefit from a society where people are able to be their authentic selves and to express themselves regardless of the gender that people perceive them to have.
Susan, we're working on a roundtable on masculinity, and I think what Chris says goes right to how we think of masculinity today. Now, obviously, this has been going on for years and years. But I wonder if some of the women came into the workplace and it didn't change is affected by the way our views about what it is to be masculine have not changed that much. You write about gender. What do you think?
Well, I think that that's absolutely true. You know, I have hesitated because I'm not really interested in politicizing this, but I think there was a conversation about this during the election. You may recall that when candidate Trump and the Access Hollywood tapes came out, and he spoke, boasted on the tapes about groping anybody he wanted to, mm-hmm. forcing himself on women, there was another online outpouring of women talking about times that had happened to them. And I think in the context of the run-up to the debate, there were a lot of questions about, is this the moment, not the run-up to the election, is this the moment when there is a barrier going to be broken, a woman would be president, and what does that mean for men and for women? I do believe, you know, there's a very active movement among many men who have questioned whether traditional masculine roles are very confining, very limiting, as our caller said, that in fact men are hurt by being restricted to a narrow emotional palate, and men are hurt when they aren't taught how to think about emotions, name them, and the men are forced into roles that can be confining. So I do believe these questions are out there. I think they've been subsumed a little because the election seemed to suggest that there's another group of men who are very resentful about how gender roles have been changing and felt that Donald Trump, in some ways, in addition to whatever political or economic program he had, embodied a kind of dominant white male, you know, persona that symbolizes a time when men were running the show. So I think we have a really interesting moment in the U.S. when many very, very different ideas of what a real man is are out there and being debated and digested.
Susan Chira is with us. If you've just joined us, she's a senior correspondent and an editor on gender issues at the New York Times. And Shireen Alamzada is with us. She's an attorney and the co-founder of Healing to Action. We asked them to step into this discussion today because in the wake of what's been happening with these allegations against Harvey Weinstein and what has happened with hashtag MeToo on Twitter, I think a lot of women are acknowledging that this is the kind of thing we talk about among our friends. We're all aware of it. We've all had experiences with sexual harassment or assault, and it is something that in many cases we choose not to speak up about, not to tell. And I've been examining why I made those decisions. I wanted to know how you make those decisions. And then this conversation is going to include, what do we do about it when you should tell? And is this a moment that something actually, that's the only way change comes around, right? If we tell, if we speak out. But how do we get there, given a lot of the barriers that are up against women to talk about this, to talk openly? 651-227-6000. If you've been in this situation to make these choices, how do you look back on that decision? Are you in it right now? 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, where Reverend Rebecca says this happens in her field. She says part of the sexual violence epidemic are the theologies which say women and feminine identified people are created subordinate. And Emily says the choice is not always report or not, but quit your job or not. And to the phones to Melissa, listening in Pepin, Wisconsin. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your story on this?
Well, I went into the military very early when they were just going co-ed. And in fact, I was among the first group of women to go through basic at Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I was very proud of that. I did very well. And in my permanent duty station, when I got into my service, my sergeant in charge sexually assaulted me and basically threatened my career. I was very vocal about it, and I went up the chain of command, and it basically ended my military career. I was discharged honorably, but I never felt good about that discharge.
Wow. He threatened you to not talk, to not report it?
Oh, absolutely. Up against the wall, with not going into details, but he was a very strong, big man.
And when you reported it would you go to the person of rank ahead of you, or how does this work in the military?
Well, I went to the sergeant in command before it goes up to the commanding officer, and he kind of poo-pooed it, but I was a good soldier, so I had a reputation for honesty and integrity. I would not keep quiet about it. And whenever this sergeant would approach me, I would simply lock up and just refuse to do anything. And so, it gets noticed by other staff. They pulled me from that duty station and put me in another duty station. They started doing temporary assignments and getting me off base, and they offered to transfer me. But I knew the culture would not change. I saw that wherever I would go, this would be very prevalent, and I made the decision to take the discharge that they offered me.
Wow. And as you look back on that decision, how do you feel about it today?
Well, it's tough because I would have done very well, and I was very proud of the work that I had done to get to the place that I had. I was a very well-performing soldier and often put in charge of the women in my squad and on my floor and whatnot. So it's been very difficult. I did further my career in other areas that are somewhat, they call it paramilitary, but I wouldn't quite say that, in areas of EMS and whatnot. But you have to remain independent. It's really, you get too much under the thumb of hierarchical command, and you're looking at trouble.
Melissa, I'm really glad you heard the show. And you had a chance to call in. Thank you. Shireen, has this changed much in the military today?
No, I think there are still very similar barriers to coming forward. I want to thank the caller so much for calling and sharing her story. It sounds like a very painful story, and it means a lot to have it heard on the air. I think, as I was listening to her, I was thinking about what sounded like a lot of trauma that she was experiencing that was manifesting in her responses as she was around the person that had harmed her.
Right.
And it just reminded me of what a human cost there is. Not just, you know, I mean, obviously for her, her career, but it sounds like there is a huge cost to the military as well, and a huge cost to employers when they lose these employees, whether they lose them because they leave or they lose them because they're not the employee they once were, because they are scared to come to work, because they have health issues that arise as a result of the harm, because their productivity suffers, because they don't buy into the workplace culture anymore. And so I do think that these kinds of harms that people suffer, a lot of the time the institution, whether it's the military or an employer, they put something else above that cost. They put, you know, the reputation of the institution. They put the profit margin of the institution, the threat of liability, above the opportunity to take that moment and to really try to shift the culture and to really try to engage with the person that's been harmed, to support them and to figure out ways that they can, as an institution, change their response and prevent it from happening to people in the future.
Boy, you know, Susan, I hear this loud and clear. It's powerful when Shireen says the company, whether they think they are or not, the institution is making a choice to put something above having a culture that does not accept this. And I wonder how much that filters down from the top.
According to the EEOC report and according to EEOC people that I've spoken with, it's absolutely mandatory. Nothing will happen until the top leaders of any company or workplace completely take this on board and signal that it's completely unacceptable and that women who speak out will be supported. It can't be done unless it's embraced at the top. And that's one of the really strong conclusions of EEOC study that you alluded to, and I think I'm referring to the same one because
right.
I've read it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because what you see is that if employees feel, well, there may be one sympathetic boss, but ultimately it's going to go up the chain and go nowhere, that won't help either.
Amy says on Twitter, what to do when the owner of your company is inappropriate, yet there isn't an HR department? I couldn't just quit my job. Shireen, I'm going to put that to you since you're an attorney as well. What to do when you work in a company like that and there is an HR to go to?
Well, those are very difficult situations. And actually, one of the challenges of working at small companies is that sometimes the civil rights laws don't actually protect employees. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act only applies to businesses with 15 or more employees. So a lot of people working at smaller businesses are not protected under the federal law. That being said, there's a lot of states that have passed laws to expand those protections. And so I believe in Minnesota, under the State Human Rights Act, which also protects against sexual harassment, that smaller employers are also covered. When there's no HR department, unfortunately, the law still for the most part, the law still requires that the employer have notice that harassment is happening. So if you are, for example, being harassed by a coworker, you would still need to go to a higher up. Now, when the higher up is the harasser and there's no other way to address the situation, then for the most part, that is an exception in which people can pursue liability against the employer, despite the fact that they weren't able to formally report it, because it's obviously it makes sense that you had really no options available to you other than filing a complaint against the employer with a civil rights agency like the EEOC, or in the case of a small employer like a human rights commission at the state level.
Okay, so Amy, there are options for you, and including the EEOC and filing complaints outside the company. Teresa says on Twitter, reported a coworker to my boss, but I reported while pregnant. The boss said it was, quote, hormones making me read it wrong. David says it starts with men admitting our complicity with the system. We need to change the belief in this that this toxic masculinity is normative. And to Matt, listening in Minneapolis. Hey, Matt, I'm glad you waited.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
So, yeah, what comes up for you as you listen to this?
So I just have a really quick question. I'm listening to all this, and there are clear points where men take it too far. They break the law. Melissa was an excellent example, the previous caller, where she was sexually assaulted. That sergeant should have been court-martialed. He should be in jail. I get that. Now, where are we drawing the line as a society to say this over here is wrong and this over here is wrong? If perception is reality and every person is different, every woman is different, every man is different, how do we determine on a social level that one thing is inappropriate, whether it might be inappropriate to a woman, say, a comment or a, like, I think you guys brought up inappropriate, like, pickup lines or passes at a bar. Some people may find that offensive, while other people may not. How do we as a society decide where to draw the line?
Matt, this is in fact, this is such a good question that I think we could do a whole show on it. And I really don't think Matt is going, oh, poor men, they don't know what to do here. I think there was some nuance in his question. How to draw the line, Shireen, and how to understand what's happening in the moment. What would you say about that?
So I would say that, you know, obviously people have different thresholds of what they find to be offensive. But what's not subjective, what's objectively true is that this is a pervasive problem for women in our society that we've seen through the hashtag, but we also know through the statistics that it's happening to one in four women in our society. And so recognizing that and being aware of that when you're interacting with women is really important, because what that helps you to see is that they are living in a constant state of threat that this kind of violence will happen. And so the interactions that you have, which may not seem offensive or may, you know, not be meant to be offensive, if you can understand that larger context and the fact that the way that our society works, that there is this underlying fear of violence, there is this underlying threat of violence, then it can enable you to think critically about what you're saying. I think the other thing that I would advise is to really be open to when women do share that something that you've said has offended them or hurt them, because it's an opportunity. And I think there is a lot of defensiveness that does happen. It's just a natural reaction that when somebody tells you, well, what you said was sexist, or you wouldn't have said this if I was a man,
right?
The natural reaction is to respond and say, no, that's not true. That I'm a feminist, or I'm not a sexist. But to recognize we all have these mistakes that we make. And we all, you know, we are all growing up in this society where there are these gender roles, and we're all sort of hostage to them in a certain way. And so really allowing yourself to listen when people are saying things that you may not want to hear, and be open to that, be humble, and also being aware of the power that men have simply by virtue of not being on that, not being included in that statistic at the same level. Not to say that men are not also survivors, many men are, but that essentially that there's sort of two worlds that we're operating in. And that's why the things that you say might be colored a different way when speaking to somebody that doesn't have that same power that you do.
What do you think, Susan? How would you respond to Matt?
Yes, Shireen did a great, thorough answer. I would say that the only thing I guess I would add is that I think it's really a matter of listening and being observant. You know, women usually send signals when they are uncomfortable. Hopefully they would say, you know what, I'm not interested
right.
in going down this road.
Right.
Those remarks, I don't want to go there. I want this to be a professional relationship. Let's move away from this, you know, or if you notice body language, discomfort, you know, try to be observant. You know, if a woman is having trouble saying it frontally, if you're watching, I think you can pick up, you know, that women are not enjoying this. And I think, you know, in addition to the be open, you might say, is this comfortable? You know, it's very hard for us because flirting and sexuality, which are part of in the environment that we swim in,
exactly,
can be very, very subtle, but often it isn't voiced. And I think it's uncomfortable to voice it, but it might be, you know what, I'm interested. Is this okay? You know, you have to be a little brave. Put it out there so that you can get a clear answer. And I think, honestly, you can get a clear answer. And if you're finding, as a man, that you're getting mixed signals, you might say, I'm not sure what I'm hearing. I'm not sure what you're saying. Can you help me understand?
That's good. I also want to say something about the power dynamic, because I'm hearing from so many people on Twitter, you know, he was 38, I was 22. If you're in, and I don't think we should have to tell men this, but if you're in a situation where you have a lot of the power, an employment situation, any kind of situation, that's where to really think twice about an approach to a woman flirtatiously dating, touching, etc. Susan, do you want to add to that?
Yes, absolutely. And what I would say is that I believe that in a workplace situation, someone who is your superior or above you in the hierarchy, there's inherently a power mismatch there. And that's very dangerous territory for sexual come-ons.
So the phone's here to Sarah in Stillwater. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to call and share that while I was in college at the University of Minnesota working in a local restaurant, I got to the point with the comments and suggestions from the cooks that I became so fearful. And when I spoke up, my schedule got changed to times when I couldn't be there. I ended up quitting because I was basically forced to and felt so uncomfortable. But at the time, I did have a support system and found my way to the Human Rights Commission. And, you know, we're talking, this was back in 1993, but the Human Rights Commission in St. Paul walked me through a process where that hopefully something's changed there. I'm not quite sure, but at the end of the day, at least I, as a college student, got some compensation. But it was, you know, as a young woman, as you were just saying, as a young woman to go through that. I mean, right now I can feel myself getting emotional again. It's hard. I mean, in knowing when you have to protect yourself and when is it that the line's going to be crossed. And that's where I was at. I was actually fearful.
Sarah, I'm really glad for your call. And you bring up something I'm hearing from a lot of women here who are, you know, this happened in the restaurant business. We heard from a woman who bartends at a hotel. Shireen, I want to say this. It struck me that if women in Hollywood, and I know what the power dynamic is all about in Hollywood, and tech and media and executive level companies don't feel empowered to speak out, I can't imagine what it's like for women who you're starting out in your career, you're making an hourly wage, you're working retail, I worked in the restaurant business for a long time as I was getting started in radio and TV. You really don't feel empowered to say anything about this because you need the money. What do we do for those women who don't, you know, have the feel empowered to speak out?
Yes, I think statistically, you see a much higher prevalence of sexual harassment in those industries. So you see it in the restaurant industry. It's extremely pervasive. About 2/3 of restaurant workers who were surveyed by the Restaurant Opportunity Center said that they were experiencing this kind of harassment on a weekly basis. You know, other industries like farm workers, hotel housekeepers, they have also reported very high rates, much higher than the average rate of harassment, 60%, 80%.
Wow.
And so it's very clear that the wage structure of some of these jobs, particularly in the service industry where people are relying on tips to make their livelihood,
mm-hmm.
And customer satisfaction, which can be defined so many different ways, are under a lot of pressure and have very little power to resist unwanted sexual advances. And so I do think that this is really an important point to touch on because I worry sometimes with the media narrative that people will see this as a Hollywood problem.
Right.
There's been a lot of talk about how Hollywood is a particularly, you know, sexualized industry, or there's really huge gender disparities in terms of the leadership, but that's the case for almost all of these industries. And low-wage workers, that's actually the population that Healing to Action works with. And we see that that calculus I mentioned at the beginning of the call is just so much more stark for people who are living paycheck to paycheck, for people who are single parents, for young people, as you mentioned, who are just entering the workforce and who maybe have no idea what acceptable workplace behavior looks like and have been experiencing harassment on the streets and in their schools. And they don't really understand that this is not appropriate behavior in the workplace. So I think these industries really deserve our attention. And there's things that can change structurally in a lot of these industries. And I think the main, that one of the big things that can change is the economic insecurity that is there. So, you know, having higher wages, having more job protections, having protected leave and, you know, other things that a lot of workers in low wage and precarious work don't have. These are really important bulwarks so that people feel secure in coming forward and saying, you know, this is happening to me and it's not okay.
Karen says on Twitter, I would say to your caller, and I think she's speaking to Matt, when in doubt, don't do or say it. If you do cross someone's line, apologize, back off, read the context, which is what Shireen and Susan were saying. And Lisa says, my boss terrorized me and told me he'd destroy my career and that I wouldn't be believed. I was young and he was powerful. So, Susan, let's come back to kind of where I started, which is, are we in a moment where there's some real change, or are we in that, you know, that moment during the campaign where women were talking about being groped and assaulted and we all, you know, talked about it and then nothing really happened? So what do you think?
You know, journalists are terrible predictors, so I'm going to be careful.
Noted.
There. I have a terrible track record, right? You know, I have been certainly struck by the fact that this conversation is not going away. And that there have been tangible consequences in these industries. You know, people have, in fact, lost jobs, so that there are sort of object lessons. Now, I really can't tell you, is this going to be a sea change? I certainly see that there's much more consciousness. There's much more public discussion. What happens from now on in is really going to depend on many, many individual companies and workplaces who need to take this on board, and it's going to depend, I think, on the robustness of those agencies that are supposed to help women and protect them and how stringently these are enforced. So you have private enterprise, you have the role of government. You know, as I say, I think we are at a cultural moment, mm-hmm. and, you know, we have to sort of stay tuned to see if that translates into concrete steps that actually improve the situation. And I want to apologize. I have to cycle off the call
now
to prepare for another interview, but
I'm
so much grateful to be part of this discussion. Thank you both.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Susan, really good to have you. Shireen, I want to pick up on that because we also saw in this EEOC report that this sexual harassment training that companies do once a year doesn't really work. What if you're the leader of an institution, whether it's a college, a company, a nonprofit, how can you communicate about this in a way that's going to be meaningful to change the culture inside that organization?
So I was speaking recently with an employer in Chicago that I really respect, and they are part of a high road roundtable. It's employers that are coming together to try to improve labor standards for workers. And what she said to me really struck me because she said, you know, to be on the high road, you have to recognize that it's a road.
Wow.
And that you're moving along it. And it's not, you know, you can't have the perfect policy. You can't have one training that's going to change the perspective of every single employee that you have and prevent harassment from ever happening.
Right.
So you have to be committed to the process. That means having training and having a good policy, but that's never going to be enough. And regardless of, you know, what that training looks like, there will be incidents where you fail as a company and where this happens because it's so pervasive. It's such a prevalent issue, not just in the workplace, but throughout, and you can't inoculate yourself against it. So I think the most important thing that companies can do is really shift their attitude about this and really think, okay, I don't need to be the all-star, you know, like, one of the things you see a lot of times when a company comes under fire for this is them putting out a statement of their values and how they don't agree with this kind of behavior and this is not their identity
right.
and who they are.
Right.
And the reality is, well, it happened, you know, and so that doesn't mean very much. What are you going to do now? You know, what steps are you going to take? How are you going to acknowledge where you failed? How are you going to work to fix those steps and not just treat this as a PR issue? And so I think that's really what needs to shift, because as we talked about earlier, a lot of companies are much more interested in protecting their reputation than they are in protecting their employees. And it's not to say they don't want to protect their employees. It's just to say that if that's the decision they have to make, I mean, that is really what HR was designed to do. HR was designed to protect companies, in some ways to protect them against their employees, against claims of liability. And so we really need to think about how can we shift the culture of companies where they can accept that they're going to mess up sometimes, that nothing they're going to do is going to completely prevent this from happening, and just commit to a long-term process of listening to their employees and trying to improve.
On Twitter, a listener says, race plays a big role here also. I immediately became the N-word at a job after I tried to report inappropriate sexual advances. And a call here from Jill in Moundsview. And Jill, I apologize. I only have a couple minutes here, but I wanted to hear from you.
Really quick. Years ago, I worked in television, and I worked with a sound mixer. It was just him and me in the production in the audio booth. And for 2.5 years, every day, I dealt with very, very sexually charged looks, comments, expressions. And I never knew. I felt powerless because he was a couple decades my senior, and he was an Emmy Award-winning mixer. And I thought if I spoke up, I would just shake up the production and cause a ruckus. So I just put up with it. In my job right now, I deal with this subtly, but it's those subtle things that, you know, I've got a coworker who sometimes if I approach him, he'll pat his lap for me to sit on his lap. And it makes me uncomfortable, but I don't know how to, in the past in my work, when people have spoken up about things, they get ridiculed and everybody knows who complains. So I just smile and try to back out of the situation.
Okay. So the next time this happens where the guy pats his lap, what are you going to say? After listening to the show.
I don't even know.
Shireen, what's Jill going to say?
Oh, well, I definitely can't tell Jill what to say. And I you know, I think it's what I tell survivors that I speak with is that they really understand their situation and context the best. And, you know, again, it's all about the context and what are the risks in that specific situation. And the problem is that a lot of times, you know, what Jill is doing is really the only option that is available other than leaving the job or giving up on your career dreams. And so, you know, I really appreciate you sharing that story. But I don't, you know, I think what one thing that I want to just mention is, you know, we are trying to come up with concrete solutions for people when they are in these situations.
Right.
But one thing to remember is that these situations are very traumatic and they take a lot of power away from people. And so we have to be really careful about telling people what they should do in these situations, because that's also taking power away from them. So
I hear you. You're saying what I wanted to say is Jill still there. Jill, what I wanted to say to you is tell that guy it makes you uncomfortable. Please not to do it. But now I hear what Shireen says about that. You have to assess what is right for you. Can I just say this? I am so grateful for everyone who called in and tweeted in to tell me what this has been like for you, to be candid and to be honest about it. So I thank you for the call. Shireen, thank you.